Adelaide, 1964. The music rises. I went to the fortune teller, had my fortune read. I didn't know what to tell her, had a dizzy feeling in my head. Turn off those long-haired poofters, my father screamed as he twisted the Astor television's protruding black knob to off. My favorite music show, Commotion, was on the living room TV, and now there was commotion in the living room itself. The longest-haired Australian group of 1966, The Throb, had just been shut down, cut off in mid-verse. My brother, sister, and I were not shocked by Dad's outburst, just a little jarred. Dad's moods were erratic, more so these days. His income was mostly derived from the racetrack. As a bookmaker, his fortunes would rollercoaster like his moods. He was repulsed by the unkempt look of the new breed of pop stars. He was fine with Johnny O'Keefe and all those up to the emergence of the Beatles. It was the long hair and the even crazier clothes that he couldn't cope with. As kids, Dad got us interested in popular music and culture. He loved it more than most of the other kids' parents we knew. He brought home the latest records, wore the best suits, often tailor-made. He loved dancing, dinner parties, and entertaining. He brought home a television set as soon as they were available in Adelaide in 1959. From the age of 6 or 7, I remember him playing records, the Everly Brothers, Bird Dog, Nat King Cole, Johnny Cash, Frank Sinatra, and a big collection of 45s, as well as many exotic-looking LPs. Although I loved Elvis as a kid, attending most of his movies, my fascination for pop and rock fully ignited when the Beatles changed the whole game. I was 10. I'd been keenly appreciative of music and entertainers up to that time, but it was this new period from early 1964 that really delivered something magical and something possible to imagine myself getting involved in. There was only one Elvis. He was perfect and unreachable. Now there was a possibility of making music as a gang, sharing the weight in a small self-sufficient unit. The Rolling Stones were a gang with Jagger as a frontman. The Beatles were a four-guy gang who supported each other with no real frontman. I started buying records for the first time in 1964. Firstly, singles I saw standing there, then EPs, 5x5, next were the albums, Please Please Me and 12x5. Living in Adelaide seemed like no impediment to experiencing this unprecedented surge of teen-oriented pop. Adelaide learned quickly and embraced the tidal wave rapturously. Adelaide seemed surprisingly hip in 1964-65. It had its own live television variety Tonight Show on NWS Channel 9, four nights a week, compared by Lionel Williams and later Ernie Sickley. Featured often were brilliant Adelaide music acts, including The Twilights, The Vibrants and Bev Harrell. Johnny Mac had a nationwide hit with his single Pink Champagne, which, although it wasn't groovy, proved that an Adelaide act could cut a record and have it burst out of our little city onto the national stage. Anything was possible. Adelaide also had a keen fashion sense. It helped having the satellite city of Elizabeth only 16 miles away. Elizabeth had about 4,000 residents, the great majority being newly imported English migrants. Their first-hand knowledge of the British fashion and music scene contributed greatly to Adelaide's advantage. It's well documented that Adelaide had the largest turnout in the world to welcome the biggest music sensation, the Beatles, to town on the 12th of June 1964. My brother's birthday coincided with the excitement. He was turning 15 and he got two tickets that my parents managed to buy from the Adelaide Advertiser Classifieds. At school that day, the Beatles were the only topic of conversation, including from our teachers. School attendance was way down on that day. A few short months later, I began to attend my first live pop concerts. I was dropped off by either my mother or father. The Centennial Hall and the Theban Theatre were two big venues for concerts. Australian and English acts were bundled together and rolled out to perform stunning 20-minute sets. Normie Rowe, Tony Worsley, the Easy Beats, Man for Man, the Honeycombs, the Kinks. We were in heaven seeing five or more fabulous acts all in one big show. I attended these events with various school friends. In 1966, Don Dunstan, future Premier of South Australia, dropped his son Andrew, a friend of mine from school, and me off to see the Easy Beats perform a spectacular concert. Stevie Wright had the energy and optimism of a pack of school kids on show day. He leapfrogged over guitarist George and Harry, in between singing and dancing with otherworldly confidence, like no other frontman in Australia. The shows were simple, personal, with few effects. They were incredibly exciting. On the broad, high wooden stage sat a few amps, a PA system, and the pop sensation of the moment. Screams, mostly from girls, and streamers elevated the excitement to an unforgettable intensity. Over the next couple of years, I witnessed amazing concerts in those intimate old halls. The Who causing havoc on stage in 1968. The Small Faces with a nasty Steve Marriott up front, and local boys, the Master's Apprentices, with the ever-enthusiastic, ever-charismatic Jim Keys. He was a world-standard star. It started to occur to me that perhaps I could get on the inside of all this excitement. I asked Mum and Dad for a set of drums, and to my surprise received them on my 13th birthday. I banged and bashed on a set of red tempo drums, not Ludwig like Ringo's. I played along to the Easy Beats Volume 3 LP and was even sent to drum lessons, thanks to Mum. My teacher was John Reynolds, who taught from his drum shop on Weymouth Street, Adelaide. Unfortunately, I didn't learn much. John was always breaking off my lesson to answer the phone and do more business. Written drum music didn't make much sense to me anyway. I was hopeless at reading it. Eventually, I stopped the lessons but kept on drumming, teaching myself. I admired some of the boys at my school who occasionally performed at assemblies and special events. One of my friends was a prominent performer, far more advanced than me, John James Hackett. He was a natural, building out a tight 60s instrumental with a guitarist and bass player on the Memorial Hall stage at St. Peter's College. The hall was full of students for assembly. I was thoroughly impressed and envious. I could never be that good. Still, I kept practicing and occasionally jamming with any school friends who shared my enthusiasm. In 1968, Jumping Jack Flash burst through the radio, reviving the Stones' slightly sagging career. A school friend, Guy Kandel, brought his little amp into the same room as me. This was the first time I played with anything other than a record player. Guy Kandel and J.J. Hackett teamed up once school finished, established themselves in Mount Gambier for a short period before the next phase of their musical careers. John James Hackett quickly progressed musically and career-wise. He soon joined local Adelaide musicians, the Fabulaires, then moved on to national fame with Ross Wilson and the very successful Mondo Rock. Apart from the drums, I attempted to learn the flute. I began lessons at school around the age of 14. The problem again for me was reading music. It was like learning Latin. It simply didn't come easily. I tried but stumbled so much that my teacher fired me. She simply gave up in frustration. Goodbye, hopeless boy, she must have thought. Like the drums, I continued playing my flute on my own, playing mostly by ear as I still do. The next experience of creating music with another person was with Scott Hicks, film director of Shine, The Boys Are Back, and No Reservations. In 1969, Scott lived in a modest home with his South African parents in the beachside suburb of Henley Beach. Scott had purchased a small artwork of mine that I managed to consign to a shop near our school. The artwork was an image of John Lennon, which I copied from the White Album's 8x10 photo of him. I coloured a small part of it with texture pens, making one of Lennon's glasses a psychedelic spiral. That artwork was my very first art sale. Scott was a year above me. He was very scholarly. I never understood why he would be interested in befriending me. He had noticed a poem I'd written, which was in the school magazine. It was written in French, a subject I was hopeless at, and eventually failed. The poem was about a dog, a chien. We did, however, share a love of pop music, and Scott loved photography. Several weekends were devoted to playing songs like Hey Jude and Donovan's Atlantis in his parents' living room. Scott sang and played the piano while I bashed away on the drums. We were never much good, but it was fun. In In a few months, Scott went on to Flinders University to study film, leaving his piano, our musical aspirations, and our friendship behind. As soon as I turned 16, I sat for and easily got my learner's driver's license. There was no intermediary P-plate system then. It didn't take much longer to gain my full license. Having the use of a car opened up possibilities that were previously out of reach. I could drive myself to see bands on the weekends, venturing sometimes as far as the Octagon in Elizabeth to see Billy Thorpe blast away. I borrowed the parents' white Holden one Saturday night to see Fraternity play at a youth centre dance on Paynham Road. Fraternity was a hot Adelaide band of 1971, having moved from Sydney to a farm in Aldgate in the Adelaide Hills. They were set to take Australia and the world by storm. Their manager, Hamish Henry, was a visionary who handled them like a special product. They all lived and rehearsed in one big house modelled on the band's base called the Big Pink in Woodstock, New York. Their sound was somewhat like the band too. Most importantly, they were fabulous, and their lead singer was the incredible Bon Scott, later to join AC/DC. Bon had moved across from the teeny bopper Perth band The Valentines to pursue this new venture. He changed his pop style and image to blend into the earthy, hippie Fraternity style. The band rolled along like an old country truck. Most venues at that time were unlicensed, no alcohol. The crowd was often as young as 14, ranging up to 18. This night at the youth centre, Fraternity's seven members swelled onto the stage. Bon took control and was utterly charismatic. The swirling music was supreme and irresistible. I found it easier and more productive to go out by myself. I didn't like getting caught up in negotiating plans with several friends, compromising on a Friday or Saturday night. I didn't like being bogged down by a group of guys who were indecisive or even dopey. I liked to slip into a place by myself to observe and plot how I might one day get to speak to a girl. I was very inexperienced with girls. My schools, after third grade, were all single-sex, boys-only schools. I went firstly to East Adelaide Primary School, then King's College, now Pembroke, for a year, and then finally St. Peter's College. My mother drove this trajectory ever upward of educational opportunities. She was good like that, and I'm grateful. Thanks, Mum. My exposure to girls was limited to my sister and her friends, then later to school dances where the boys were paired off with girls from suitable private schools. My partners were mostly taller, more developed, and not at all interested in me. I wasn't sure how to approach girls. I made a couple of meek efforts, but they were not even picked up on by my targets. I needed an approach that would really work. I'd recently watched The Nutty Professor starring Jerry Lewis, and it made a huge impact on me. Jerry, as Buddy Love, was the coolest guy around. When he transformed himself from an invisible nerd into the groovy, swinging ladies' man, Buddy Love, he was unstoppable and irresistible to females. I figured I might be capable of this too. One Saturday night, I took myself to the Scene Club in the city. It was an unlicensed venue where the latest supergroup, Axiom, were performing. Axiom formed from the embers of two big Australian bands, The Twilights and The Group. Glenn Shorrock, later to front the Little River Band, took lead vocals, backed up by Brian Cadd on vocals and keyboards. As I entered, I told myself that I too could be like Buddy Love. I conjured up his spirit and let him take over. It took a few moments to locate a girl who looked sassy and sexy. Then I told myself, "This is it. That's your girl. You can do this, Buddy." I strolled over to her and said, "Hi, I thought I'd do a favor and talk to you. I wanted to share some of my incredibleness with you." She was clearly taken aback. It took a moment. The girl was a little stunned and momentarily impressed. I thought I was onto something. The only problem was staying in character. I brought her a Coke and held her attention for a few minutes more, but gradually I became my real self again, losing Buddy's spirit. As this happened, just like in the movie, she looked at me quizzically, then made an excuse to go. It was an interesting experiment, though, and with more effort and practice, I figured I might actually get my first girlfriend. Back to Fraternity, on stage at the youth centre. They were cooking up a wonderful storm on stage, and I really wanted to dance, but definitely not by myself. That just wasn't done, unless you were an oddball. It was simply too embarrassing. Besides, I wanted to meet a girl. Looking around, I saw a beautiful girl by the side of the stage. She had long dark hair and clear, smooth olive skin. She oozed a naughty confidence. Without letting it go on too long, in case I backed out, I walked straight over to her and asked her to dance. I couldn't allow myself any time to think about the consequences. To my amazement, she agreed. Dancing with this gorgeous stranger to the incredible fraternity with Bon Scott just a few feet away was exhilarating. I was in the happiest place imaginable. Even more astounding, when the song finished, she didn't walk away as I fully expected. She stayed with me. Perhaps I was dreaming. Never before had this happened. Her name was Marianne. My hand touched her arm. Then I held her a little. She felt heavenly. Time disappeared once I knew she was happy to keep dancing with me. Before I knew it, I was holding her closely to a slow song. Then my mouth touched her mouth. This was to be my first real kiss. Once my lips touched hers, Marianne took over. She was in charge and was clearly experienced. The kiss was an out-of-this-world experience that I'd never known before. From the amazing kiss to Marianne's tongue gently touching mine, then moving in circles, it was wildly stimulating. I'd never known anything like it, like an alien drilling into my mind. I was 17 and she was 14. In the middle of this newly found bliss and totally on another planet by now, I felt a tap on my shoulder. Breaking off the kiss, I turned to the direction of the tapping hand. At once, my face was pounded by a solid fist that launched me backwards, then straight down on the floor. Pleasure and pain, my first taste and personal experience with teen lust. Marianne had to leave soon after I recovered from the punch. Her dad was picking her up. All was not lost, however. We exchanged phone numbers, gold. The twerp who hit me disappeared. I pulled myself together and left once fraternity had exited the stage. Outside in the car park, the attacker reanimated. I jumped in my parents' Holden, and he began to kick it. I cranked the motor and turned the car towards him. That did it. He ran off. I never saw him again. I later found out that he had a giant crush on Marianne, but she didn't feel the same about him. That began an almost 4-year boyfriend-girlfriend relationship between Marianne and me. We made phone contact a couple of days after that first night. Marianne lived in a suburb called Paradise. It was an aspirational name. In reality, it was a new, mostly lower-income suburb. Her parents were Austrian-German, recent migrants. Her dad was a builder. She had an older brother, Alfie. The weekend after we first met, Marianne caught the bus, a 20-minute ride down Paynham Road to my suburb, Royston Park, to visit me. I was very expectant and excited. She knocked at our back door, looking as fresh and beautiful as I remembered. My heart beat noticeably faster. Dad was home. He said a quick hello, unable to hide the admiring look in his eye. This was the first time my dad had seen me with a girl. I had an easy connection with Marianne. I didn't have to put on a different personality or find false bravado. We were simply drawn to each other. Even though we didn't have a lot in common, Marianne was sharp, but she wasn't academic. She did the bare minimum at high school beyond merely showing up. She wasn't a reader, nor musical or artistic. She had style, sass, and she loved pop music. We didn't discuss poetry or books, we just spent time together, and that was enough. In my bedroom, we would lay close, fully dressed, cuddling and listening to LPs, often Freeze Highway album. I never thought of trying to go any further than that. What could be better than the euphoria I felt at that time? Anything else would surely spoil it. Occasionally, we would be surprised, then interrupted by my mother, who would push the door open and say, "Keep this door open." I didn't quite understand her angst. Besides, my awareness had gone all gooey. I was only focused on this gorgeous girl who came and gave me lovely cuddles and kisses. It was 1971. I'd taken a year off my studies at the Art School of South Australia to get a little more life experience. In 1970, I had gone straight from fourth year high school leaving certificate to art school at 16. I was too young and too green to go straight into a tertiary institution. 1971 was to be a rocky year of extreme experiences. Marianne and I continued seeing each other regularly, at least once a week. Sometimes I'd go to her house to meet her after she got out of school and her parents weren't home. She was such a dream in her school dress. which was well above her smooth knees. Again, we merely cuddled on the couch before I had to return home. I found out that her brother, Alfie, wasn't home because he was in jail, locked up for heroin possession. There was a prevalence of drugs in Adelaide in the early 70s, especially heroin. As 1971 progressed, I couldn't justify staying home and not working. I had deferred my studies at art school for a year. I had to get a job. Jobs were very easily found in the 70s. Unfortunately, the pay wasn't much to get excited about. I was employed by Hoadley's Chocolate Factory for 50 cents an hour. This equated to a grand total of $20 a week. Terrible by any standards. I hated working in a factory with grumpy, ground-down co-workers. I never enjoyed a single day, nor made a single friend. It got me so down, in fact, that I became very sick after a few weeks with tonsillitis. With swollen tonsils and a high fever, I had to remain in bed for a couple of weeks, receiving shots from the family doctor to fight the infection. During this period, Marianne decided to quit school. She had turned 15 and she'd had enough. She found herself a job in a city sandwich shop. When I was back at the chocolate factory, I visited her at work. Our life had changed direction, but we were still bound to each other. On weekends, we would see a live band if we could. Snoopy Hollow was the big unlicensed venue in Flinders Street for teens. It was at the YMCA, where I'd learned judo as a 12-year-old and gymnastics as a 10-year-old. Now at 17, I was taking my beautiful girlfriend to see Zoot. Russell Morris, Master's Apprentices, performed their incredible hits while I danced and kissed Mary Ann. As the year moved on and the winter established itself, I decided to move out of home. My relationship with Mum had been on the rocky side since Mary Ann had been in my world. I found a spare room in a house for rent in Prospect. Two girls were renting the house. I paid them a week's rent, not feeling like this would be anything long term. Mary Ann came to visit me after a day or two. She decided, as the afternoon began to fade, to stay the night. Here we were in an independent place that was not our parents. Mary Ann climbed into bed with me, and it was unspoken but clear that we were, after more than 6 months of seeing each other, going to have sex. It proved too much for me, however. I was scared and overwhelmed. I couldn't do it. Nothing happened. We went to sleep. Up until that point, I'd been under typical pressures and hormonal changes that descend on almost all boys as they move from dinosaur obsession to mammary obsession. I fantasized daily about being with a girl, mostly a beautiful swimsuit-clad model from People or Post magazines. I cut out my favorites, pasting them in a scrapbook so I could access them any time. My gazing culminated in orgasmic explosions at least a couple of times a day. I'd wager with my crazy school friend, Michael Clark, as to who would be the first to actually have sex with a girl. Now that I'd finally had a girlfriend, I was in a position to have sex, but I'd been quite happy to delay the experience, preferring the elation of cuddles and kisses. When we woke up in the morning, I was ready, without having to think or try at all. The necessary hydraulics were all in place. This was it. "I can do it. I'm ready," I said to Marianne excitedly. We spent the day doing what I'd never done before, but had thought about so much over the past few years. That marked another new beginning. I somehow felt, too, a loss of innocence, even though I'd experienced an incredible new sensation. I felt that I experienced something that could almost never be fully satisfied. It was a bit drug-like in that way. Now that I had my first conquest, I already had a sense that this would be an ongoing, lifelong quest to prove something, to find something. I wasn't sure. The cuddles and kisses were really good. Now I've got to handle this new level, this new beast. Later that second day, there was a knock at the front door. A police officer, one of the girls, answered it. "Is there a Marianne Mura here?" the officer asked. The girl lied, saying no. We were back in our room out back. The officer went away. Marianne's parents were looking for her. She had taken off, not telling them where she'd gone. Like two unwise, crazy teenagers, we decided to exasperate the situation and simply take off. Marianne stayed with me a second night. With no belongings and very little money, we decided to hitchhike from Adelaide to Sydney. We would go to my cousin Carl's place in Sydney. He was older, married and established, a commercial artist. Marianne and I would get jobs in Sydney and make a stand. It was a truly stupid idea. We set out to hitchhike from Adelaide's foothills onto Highway 1, a 9-hour journey to Melbourne. this young-looking, almost 18-year-old guy with a petite, beautiful 15-year-old girl. Our first ride was with a semi-trailer trucker. We climbed into the large cabin, told the driver where we were headed, and then made small talk for a while. The driver didn't query our young age or our free-floating plans. Marianne sat by the passenger door. I was in the middle, next to the driver. He was a basic, decent chap. Mostly he was worried about falling asleep while driving. He asked me to pull a cord that blasted the horn if it looked like he was drifting off. Somehow we made it through the evening and to Melbourne the next morning. That day we headed to the Melbourne University. We firstly joined the line of students getting served for lunch and had a free meal. Next we went to the dorm area and asked some students if there were any unoccupied rooms. Incredibly, we were directed to one that was open and made ourselves comfortable for the night. We managed to get two more meals before finding our way to the road leading to Sydney and hitchhiking once more. Before long, we were in a vehicle headed east. Then another, and by the afternoon, we were dropped off in Albury, New South Wales, 5.5 hours from Sydney. This is where things unraveled. A police car cruised past us as we were looking for our next ride on the main road out of Albury. Marianne and I nervously looked at each other, both thinking the same thing. We had to get a lift. Instead, the police car rounded the block, then pulled up beside us. "Get in the car, please. We want to ask you a few questions," one of the officers said. We had no choice but to comply. We were taken to the Albury police station, where we sat down and the questions began. "Where are you going? Why are you hitchhiking? Where do you live? Where are your parents? What's in this bag? How old are you? What are your names?" We both made up some inept and obvious falsehoods, foolishly hoping they'd let us go. It wasn't long before we tripped over our own bull and started giving real answers. The truth was that we only had 20 cents between us and no other means of support. Marianne was 15, I was just shy of 18. We were locked up while this was straightened out. I was facing two charges, vagrancy and carnal knowledge. We were put in the police lockup attached to the police station. There were about 6 or 7 cells that faced a small courtyard. I was put at one end and Marianne at the opposite end. She was the only female. There were 3 others locked up at that time, petty car thieves or petrol stealers in their 20s and 30s. It was a nightmare to have my liberty taken away from me so completely. It was worse still to hear Marianne's miserable cries coming from her cell. "Stuart! Stuart!" she sobbed. There was nothing I could do. I was totally powerless. We were locked up for almost a week. Tests were done at the local hospital on Marianne to find any evidence of semen, so I could be charged with carnal knowledge. Fortunately, we had been on the road without much chance of intercourse since Adelaide, so nothing was found. The cells consisted of a narrow, hard bed with inadequate blankets and a toilet in the corner. There was a light that stayed on till 9 o'clock, then went off as the town hall clock counted off the 9 bells. The door had a space about 18 by 18 inches that had bars in it, allowing the cold air to come through at night. We were allowed out of our cell for an hour each day to walk around the courtyard. It was a chance to talk to the other inmates or perhaps borrow a book. Marianne was let out, not at the same time as the males. I'd heard that our parents had been contacted. My mother would be coming to Albury to be present when we appeared before the judge. Marianne's parents were not coming. On the day when we were to appear before the judge, I was brought into a room where my mother waited. I was ashamed. I cried. I was so pleased to see her, to have her comfort and familiarity. I was also frightened of what might happen when we faced the judge. The hearing went quickly, however, and the judge was an understanding and compassionate man. He looked at Marianne and then at me and pronounced, "This is a case of Romeo and Juliet. No conviction. You're free to go." Enormous relief and gratitude flooded through me. I also realized then the power of the police and the respect that needed to be shown to them if I was to get through the next stages of my life without trouble. Marianne and I flew back to Adelaide with my mother and attempted to settle back into normality. I returned to my family house and Marianne to hers. Marianne and I continued seeing each other. I suppose we were in love. We were very close. The trouble was, we were not great for each other. She was really sweet and quite independent. but partly rebellious. In 1972, I returned to art school to finish up 3 more years of my art studies. Marianne was still not doing much except various menial jobs. She also started taking pills such as speed and other things I didn't know much about at the time. She smoked cigarettes too, something I always hated. Up until I turned 18, I never took any drugs, nor smoked or drank. It was something that just occurred to me as a good idea to stay clear and clean for a while. I saw how idiotic so many guys were, sculling beer and vomiting at their 16-year-old's parties. It looked ridiculous to me. It wasn't until I was 18 I decided to break the prohibition. Marianne moved to Melbourne for a few months in 1973. She worked in a factory. I'm not sure why. We wrote letters and I missed her very much. I drove across to see her one time and she was sharing a flat with a girlfriend. It was all a bit bleak. The girlfriend seemed to be out of it on something like Valium, probably doing the drug of the time, Mandrax. I stayed for the night. We made love quietly as we shared the bed with the sedated flatmate. Then I returned to Adelaide feeling quite sad. The next time I saw Marianne, she was visiting me in Adelaide, and I was staying in the house of a mature-age student at art school. The woman was about 30. Her name was Jenny. She had a cottage in the city, and she rented the front room to me. She had been married to a prominent Brisbane artist, John Ayland, but they were now divorced. Jenny was resuming her studies at art school. Often in the evenings, Jenny and I would share a flagon of white wine after a long day in the studio. We had drinks called Hock, Lime and Lemon, part white wine, part lime juice, cordial, and part lemonade. These went down too easily. Due to this habit, I would bring to my studio the following day an aching hangover. Jenny was the first to introduce me to marijuana. The first time I tried it, I vomited after a few puffs. Marianne found me at Jenny's house. She was still beautiful, but changed somehow dulled. As she spent some time with me, it was obvious that she had a bad heroin habit. She brought this back from Melbourne. It was devastating to see her nonchalantly shooting up 2 or even 3 times a day. I knew there was nothing I could do, nothing I could conjure up to fix this. I wanted to lock her in a room until she was free from this evil crap, but that wasn't going to happen. I saw Marianne a couple more times over the next months, then never again. Communication wasn't as it is now. I left Adelaide at the end of 1974. It's been decades and I don't know if she's dead or alive, but I often think of her. She was my first love. She looked into a crystal ball, said you're in love.